TED Audio Collective.
This interview features entrepreneur and philanthropist Reed Hastings in conversation with TED curator Chris Anderson, recorded live at TED 2018.
This show is brought to you by Schwab. You're here to keep a pulse on environmental trends. Well, now you can invest in what's trending in electric vehicles, renewable energy, water sustainability, and more with Schwab Investing Themes. It's an easy way to invest in ideas you believe in. Schwab's research uncovers emerging trends, then their technology curates relevant stocks into themes. Choose from over 40 themes. Buy all the stocks in a theme as is or customize to better fit your investing goals. All in a few clicks. Schwab Investing Themes is not intended to be investment advice or a recommendation of any stock or investment strategy. Learn more at schwab.com/thematic investing. TED Talks Daily is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary.
Hi, I'm Annalise Riles, professor of law at Northwestern University, anthropologist, and host of Everyday Ambassador, a new podcast that peels back the curtains of high-stakes diplomacy and gives everyone backstage access to the most powerful methods of leadership. On each episode, we'll break things down into deceptively simple moves that everyone can make to help build a more peaceful and sustainable world. So join me and become an everyday ambassador on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen.
I have been long so fascinated and amazed by so many aspects of Netflix. You're full of surprises, if I may say so. One of those surprises happened, I think, about six years ago. So the company back then was doing really well, but you were basically a streaming service for other people's films and TV content. You'd persuaded Wall Street that you were right to make the kind of radical shift away from just sending people DVDs. So you were doing it by streaming, and you were growing like a weed. You had more than 6 million subscribers and healthy growth rates. And yet, you chose that moment to kind of make a giant, really a bet the company decision. What was that decision, and what motivated it?
Well, cable networks from all time have started on other people's content and then grown into doing their own originals. So we knew of the general idea for quite a while. And we had actually tried to get into original content back in 2005 when we were on DVD only and buying films at Sundance, Maggie Gyllenhaal's Sherry Baby, and we published on DVD. We were a mini studio, and it didn't work out because we were subscale. And then, as you said, in 2011, Ted Sarandos, my partner at Netflix who runs content, got very excited about House of Cards. And at that time, it was $100 million. It was a fantastic investment, and it was in competition with HBO, and that was really the breakthrough that he picked right up front.
But that, I mean, that was a significant percentage of the revenue of the company at that time. But how could you get confident that that was actually worth doing? If you got that wrong, it might have been really devastating for the company.
Yeah, we weren't confident. I mean, that's the whole tension of it. We're like, holy, I can't say that. It was scary.
And with that, it wasn't just producing new content. You also, pretty much with that, if I understand right, introduced this idea of binge viewing. Like, it wasn't, we're going to do these episodes and build excitement, boom, all at one time. And that consumer mode hadn't really been tested. Why did you risk that?
Well, you know, we had grown up shipping DVDs, and then there was series, box sets on DVD. And all of us had that experience watching, like, some of the great HBO content, you know, with the DVD, next episode, next episode. And so that was the trigger to make us think, wow, you know, with episodic content, especially serialized, it's so powerful to have all the episodes at once. And it's something that linear TV can't do. And so both of those made it really positive.
And so did it work out on the math pretty much straight away that an hour spent watching House of Cards, say, was more profitable to you than an hour spent watching someone else's licensed content?
You know, because we're a subscription, we don't have to track it at that level. And so it's really about making the brand stronger so that more people want to join. And House of Cards absolutely did that, because then many people would talk about it and associate that brand with us. Whereas Mad Men we carried, great show, AMC show, but they didn't associate it with Netflix even if they watched it on Netflix.
And so you added all these other remarkable series, Narcos, Jessica Jones, Orange is the New Black, The Crown, Black Mirror, personal favorite, Stranger Things, and so on. And so, I mean, this coming year, the level of investment you're planning to make in new content is not $100 million, it's what?
It's about $8 billion around the world, and it's not enough. There are so many great shows on other networks, and so we have a long way to go.
But $8 billion, that's pretty much higher than any other content commissioner at this point?
You're no, right up there, right? Disney's in that realm, and if they're able to acquire Fox, they're even bigger. But and then really that's spread globally. And so it's not as much as it sounds.
But clearly from the Barry Dillers and others in the media business, it feels like from nowhere this company has come and has really revolutionized the business. I mean, it's like as if Blockbuster one day said, we're going to make Blockbuster videos, and then 6 years later was as big as Disney. I mean, that story would never have happened, and yet it did.
That's the bitch about the internet. It moves fast. everything around us moves really quick.
I mean, there must be something unusual about Netflix's culture that allowed you to take such bold, I won't say reckless, bold, well-thought-through decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we did have one advantage, which is we were born on DVD, and we knew that that was going to be temporary. No one thought we'd be mailing discs for 100 years. So then you have a lot of paranoia about what's coming next, and that's part of the founding ethos, is really worrying about what's coming next. And so that's an advantage. And then in terms of the culture, it's very big on freedom and responsibility. I pride myself on making as few decisions as possible in a quarter. We're getting better and better at that. There's sometimes I can go a whole quarter without making any decisions.
But there are some really surprising things about your people. For example, I looked at one survey. It looks like Netflix employees, compared to your peers, are basically the highest paid for equivalent jobs and the least likely to want to leave. And if you Google the Netflix culture deck, you see this list of really quite surprising admonitions to your employees. Talk about a few of them.
Well, you know, my first company, we were very process obsessed. This was in the 1990s. And every time someone made a mistake, we tried to put a process in place to make sure that mistake didn't happen again. So very semiconductor yield orientation. And the problem is we were trying to dummy-proof the system. And then eventually only dummies wanted to work there. And so then, of course, the market shifted. In that case, it was C++ to Java. But, you know, there's always some shift. And the company was unable to adapt, and it got acquired by our largest competitor. And so with Netflix, I was super focused on how to run with no process but not have chaos. And so then we've developed all these mechanisms, super high talented people, alignment, talking openly, sharing information. And internally, people are stunned at how much information, all the core strategies, et cetera. We're like the anti-Apple, you know, how they compartmentalize. And we do the opposite, which is everybody gets all the information. And so what we're trying to do is build a sense of responsibility in people and the ability to do things. And so I find out about big decisions now that are made all the time. I never even heard about it. Which is great. And mostly they go well.
So you just wake up and read them on the internet.
Sometimes.
We just entered China.
Yeah. Well, that would be a big one. Yeah.
But you allow employees to set their own vacation time and
Sure, that's a big symbolic one, vacation, because most people in practice do that anyway. But yeah, there's a whole lot of that freedom.
And courage, you ask for as a fundamental value.
Yeah, we want people to speak the truth. And we say, you know, to disagree silently is disloyal. It's not okay to let some decision go through without saying your piece and typically writing it down. And so we're very focused on trying to get to good decisions through the debate that always happens. And we try not to make it intense, like yelling at each other or nothing like that. You know, it's really curiosity, drawing people out.
You've got this other secret weapon at Netflix, it seems, which is this vast trove of data, a word we've heard a certain amount about this week. You've often taken really surprising stances towards building smart algorithms at Netflix. Like back in the day, you opened up your algorithm to the world and said, hey, can anyone do better than this recommendation we've got? If so, we'll pay you $1 million. You paid someone $1 million because it was like 10% better than yours.
That's right.
Was that a good decision in the end? Would you do that again? Or?
Yeah, it was super exciting at the time. This is about 2007, but you know, we haven't done it again. So clearly it's a very specialized tool. And so think of that as that was a lucky break of good timing rather than a general framework. So what we've done is invest a lot on the algorithms and so that we feature the right content to the right people and try to make it fun and easy to explore.
And you made this, what seems like a really interesting shift a few years ago. You used to ask people, you know, rate your, here are 10 movies, what do you think, which ones of these are your best movies? And then tried to match those movies with recommendations for what was coming. And then you changed away from that. Talk about that.
Sure. Everyone would rate Schindler's List 5 stars, and then they'd rate Adam Sandler, you know, the do-over, 3 stars. Okay, but in fact, when you looked at what they watched, it was almost always Adam Sandler. Okay, and so what happens is when we rate and we're metacognitive about quality, that's sort of our aspirational self. And it works out much better to please people to look at the actual choices that they make, their revealed preferences by how much they enjoy simple pleasures.
Okay, so this is, I want to talk for a couple minutes about this because this strikes me as a huge deal, not just for Netflix, for the internet as a whole. The difference between aspirational values and revealed values. You brilliantly didn't pay too much attention to what people said. You watched what they did and then found the stuff that just, oh my God, I never knew I would like a show about making horrible recipes called Nailed It.
Called Nailed It, yeah, right.
It's hilarious, but that I wouldn't even have thought of that. But aren't there risks with this? If this go only with revealed values approach is taken too far?
Well, we get a lot of joy from making people happy. So sometimes you just want to relax and watch a show like Nailed It. And it's fun and it's not stressful. And other times people want to watch a very intensive film. Mudbound was Oscar nominated. It's a great, very intensive film. And, you know, we've had over 20 million hours of viewing on Mudbound, which is dramatically bigger than it would have been in the theaters or any other distribution. And so, you know, yeah, we have some candy too, but we have lots of broccoli. And, you know, if you have the good mix, you get to a healthy diet.
But, yes, indeed. But isn't it the case that algorithms tend to point you away from the broccoli and towards the candy if you're not careful? And we just had a talk about how on YouTube, somehow algorithms tend to, by being smarter, tend to drive people towards more radical or you know, specific content. It'd be easy to imagine that Netflix algorithms just going on revealed values would gradually...
Right, get too base and...
We'd all be watching violent pornography or something, or some people would, and, you know, like, how... Not me, I'm the child of a missionary, I don't even think about these things, but I mean, it's possible, right?
In practice, you're right that you can't just rely on algorithms. You know, it's a mix of judgment and what we carry. And we're a curated service versus a platform like Facebook and YouTube. So we have an easier set of issues, which is what are these great films and series that we acquire? But then within that, the algorithm is a tool.
But how... So John Doerr just talked about measuring what matters. I mean, as a business, what yep. matters, I presume, is fundamentally just in growing subscribers. I mean, that's your unique advantage. Are subscribers grown only by more time, you know, the more time they spend watching Netflix, that is what will make them resubscribe? Or is it even more about having shows that might not have been so much time as watching the whole season of Nailed It or whatever, but just get into them more? They just think, that was nourishing, that was extraordinary, I'm so glad I watched that with my family. Isn't there a version of the business model that would be less content, but more awesome content, possibly even more uplifting content?
And people choose that uplifting content. I think you're right, which is when people talk about Netflix, they talk about the shows that move them, 13 Reasons Why or The Crown, or, you know, and so that is way disproportionate in positive impact, even for the subscriber growth that you talked about, is those couple big memorable shows. But what we want to do is offer a variety. You know, you don't want to watch the same thing every night as much as you like it. You want to try different things. And what we haven't seen is this, say, race to the bottom of your violent pornography kind of examples. Instead, we've seen, you know, great viewing across a whole range. Black Mirror, you know, we're filming season 5 now. And that was a struggling show when it was only in the BBC. And with the distribution of on demand, you can make these much, much bigger shows.
You're telling me humans can get addicted by their angels as well as their demons?
Yeah, and again, you know, we try not to think about it in addiction terms. We think about it as, you know, what are you going to do with your, you know, your time and when you want to relax? And you can watch linear TV, you can do video games, you can do YouTube, or you can watch Netflix. And if we're as great as we can be and we have a variety of moods, then more often people will choose us.
But you have people in the organization who are looking regularly at sort of the actual impacts of these brilliant algorithms that you've created, just for reality check, just are we sure that this is the direction we want to go?
You know, well, I think we learn, and you have to be humble and sort of say, look, there's no perfect tool. How the algorithms, one part, the way we commission the content, our relationships with societies. So there's a lot of ways that we have to look at it. So if you get too stuck in, like, let's just increase viewing or just increase subscribers, you're unlikely to be able to grow and be the great company you want to be. So think of it as there's multiple measures of success.
So speaking of algorithms that have raised questions, I mean, you're on the board of Facebook, and I think Mark Zuckerberg, you've done some mentoring for him. What should we know about Mark Zuckerberg that people don't know?
Well, many of you know him or have seen him. I mean, he's a fantastic human being, really first class. And social, whether that's, or these platforms, whether that's YouTube or Facebook, you know, are clearly trying to grow up quickly. And we see that with all new technologies. I mean, yesterday we were talking about printed DNA, and it's like, talk about, you know, could be fantastic or could be horrific. And, you know, all new technology, when television was first popular in the 1960s in the US, it was called a vast wasteland, you know, and the television was going to rot the minds of everybody. And it turns out everybody's minds were fine. And, you know, there were some adjustments. But so think of it, I think of it as all new technologies have pros and cons. And in social, we're just figuring that out.
How much of a priority is it for the board of Facebook to really address some of the issues? Or is the belief that actually the company has been completely unfairly criticized?
Oh, it's not completely unfairly. And Mark's leading the charge on fixing Facebook. And he's, you know, very passionate about that.
Reed, I want to look at another passion of yours. I mean, you've done incredibly well with Netflix. You're a billionaire. And you spend a lot of time and indeed money on education.
Yep.
Why is this a passion and what are you doing about it?
Sure. Right out of college, I was a high school math teacher. And so when I later went into business and became a philanthropist, I think I gravitated towards education and trying to make a difference there. And the main thing I noticed is, you know, educators want to work with other great educators and to create many unique environments for kids. And we need a lot more variety in the system than we have, and a lot more educator-centric organizations. And so the tricky thing is right now in the U.S., most schools are run by a local school board. And it has to meet all needs in the community. And, And in fact, what we need is a lot more variety. So in the US, there's a form of school, of public school called charter public schools that are run by nonprofits. And that's the big emphasis for me is if you can have schools run by nonprofits, they're more mission focused. They support the educators well. And like I'm on the board of KIPP Charter Schools, which is one of the larger networks. And, you know, it's 30,000 kids a year are getting, you know, a very stimulating education.
I mean, paint me a picture of what a school should look like.
Well, it depends on the kid. Think about it as, you know, with multiple kids, there's all different needs that need to be met. So there's not any one model. And you want to be able to choose depending on your kid and what you think they need. But they should be very educator-centric and curious and stimulating and all of those things. And this whole idea of 30 kids in fifth grade all learning the same thing at the same time, you know, is clearly an industrial throwback. But changing that within the given the current government structure is super hard. But what you know, these innovative nonprofit schools are doing is, you know, pushing the bounds, letting kids, you know, try new things, and so that's the think of it as the governance reform that is the nonprofit to allow the educational changes.
And sometimes the criticism is put that charter schools intentionally or unintentionally suck resources away from the public school system. Should we be concerned about that?
Well, they are public schools. So, I mean, there's these multiple types of public schools. And, you know, if you look at charters as a whole, they serve low-income kids. Because if high-income kids get in trouble, the parents will send them to a private school or they move neighborhoods. And low-income families generally don't have those choices. Like KIPP, you know, it's 80% low-income kids, free and reduced lunch. And the college admissions for KIPP is fantastic.
Reid, you signed the Giving Pledge a few years ago. You're committed to giving away more than half of your fortune during your lifetime. Can I cheekily ask how much you've invested in education in the last few years?
It's a couple hundred million. I don't know exactly how many hundreds, but we're continuing to invest, and thank you all. You know, it's honestly, for a little while, I tried to do politics full-time, working for John Doerr. While I loved working for John, I just didn't thrive on politics. I love business. I love competing. I love going up against Disney and HBO. And you know, that's what gets me going. And now I do that to really, you know, increase Netflix's value, which allows me to write more checks to schools. So for now, it's the perfect life.
Reid, you're a remarkable person. You've changed all of our lives and the lives of many kids. Thank you so much for coming to TED.
Thank you.
For more TED Talks, go to TED.com.